Hello there. Welcome to the podcast. Today we're talking software engineering and CTO stuff. Today we've got Brandon Mathis. Here he is, Brandon Mathis. He's a full stack engineer, CTO. He's an ECU grad. My dad went to ECU, so I like ECU, even though I went to NC State. Still cool people. He runs the Triangle Devs community. It's a meetup group, and they got a Slack group. He is currently freelancing with his own company, Mathis Tech. He also serves as contract CTO for VTestify, a software company here in the Raleigh area. But he's been an instructor for Iron Yard, been director of technology for Smashing Boxes, lead developer for GoPlaySave. Really awesome guy. And he's going to drop in a lot of knowledge on us here today. So let's dive in. Well, all right. Welcome to the podcast. Brandon, how are you?
Yeah, Blake, I'm doing good, man. Thanks for having me on.
And you're very welcome. Thanks for coming on. I was excited to chat with you because we've been connected on LinkedIn for quite a while. And we've met a couple of times. This is going to be our first collab, hopefully the first of many.
Yeah, definitely, man. I mean, looking forward to it. I mean, I've been enjoying watching some of your podcast episodes, so it's fun to be on and share some of, you know, my opinions with the world.
Everybody's got them, and you might as well not keep them to yourself, right? You gotta share them. So, a couple warm-up questions here. What's your favorite movie? What's your favorite band?
Personally, me, man, you know, I'm a pretty big movie buff. One of my favorite movies. I mean, I'm a big sucker for anything done by Christopher Nolan. I mean, he's one of my favorite directors. Inception in particular.
Dreams, they feel real while we're in them, right? It's only when we wake up that we realize something was actually strange. How did you get here?
We're dreaming.
I like Inception a lot. I like to go back to that movie and rewatch it all the time. I always like Christopher Nolan, the way that like he plays with time and his stories and how he'll slow it up and speed it down. And every single one of his films has like this interesting like level of complexity in it that has to do with time. And I thought it was really cool. I mean, Inception was one of the first films that I saw that, you know, it's like you go into a dream world and then you can go into a dream within a dream. And you go like multiple levels deep into that, and time moves at different places you get in. I just always thought that was a really cool story concept. And also, special effects are really sweet. I'm a bit of a sci-fi movie buff too myself. I guess Inception is a little bit of a sci-fi film. It's pretty sci-fi technology to go inside someone's dream. If only I could go inside of the dreams of my clients, man.
Man, yeah, you'd have no problems in, right?
I could do anything, yeah.
Yeah, I wish I could hear their thoughts. I might not like them.
Yeah, well, you know.
At least I have all the ammo. But yeah, Inception's a great movie, man. I love that movie. I have to watch it two or three times just to feel like you understand what the hell is going on, how they got there.
When you said that, I actually kind of remember back. I went and saw Inception with my wife, and then we went to her parents' house for dinner that night and told them, like, oh my goodness, this movie we just saw was like, you have to see it. So we went the next day and saw it again with them. And yeah, definitely a movie that if you watch it multiple times, you're going to learn something a little different. Definitely the second, third, and fourth go around. So I won't admit here how many times I've watched it, though. It's one of my, maybe not a guilty pleasure, but definitely a film I enjoy a lot. So.
Yeah, I've watched it a few times, and Interstellar's kind of along those lines where you get the time warp going through the black hole and everything. Mm-hmm. You got to watch that one. Yeah, and you never really know what's going on. How did he wind up in the future? I don't know.
That's a wild one. I'm also a really big fan of Tenet. Christopher Nolan's films that has a really interesting time travel like approach to it. I mean, I love movies that have time travel in them, you know, the implication of going forward or back in time, what it could do. So, you know, Tenet, also a movie I really enjoy a lot. Yeah, just a big fan of the Christopher Nolan films that are out there. Also The Dark Knight, I won't lie, you know, I'm a bit of a Batman fan too. Not so much playing around with time in Batman, though.
Well, Batman never dies, right? He lives on forever. So that's right. I guess that's kind of playing with time there. somebody needs to bring back to the Future. I don't know. I think Netflix, I thought they were rumored to have something going on. And so they need to reboot that series because it's too good not to.
Definitely, man. I mean, like, what a crazy, like, I mean, with all the reboots that are going on these days, like, man, what a valuable piece of IP, like, sitting there. Someone really should get into that. Back to the Future. I saw that film when I was a little kid, man. That's a good one. So
I love Back to the Future. Yeah, are you a Star Wars fan at all?
Yeah, man. I had the experience when I was a little kid sitting there with my dad watching Empire Strikes Back. And I actually did not get the Darth Vader is Luke's father thing spoiled to me. And I forever remember sitting there at my aunt's house. We're watching it on the old VHS, you know, and the whole time my dad's back there and he's like, Darth Vader, that dude, that's a bad dude right there. He's tough. That's a bad dude right there. You know, and I'm always really worried, you know, oh no, is Luke going to make it? And then that moment, the Luke, I am your father moment. Like, I feel like all around the world, that's been spoiled for anyone before they even get to see Star Wars. But when I was a little kid, I was like,
no, I am your father. Join me and together we can rule the galaxy as father and son.
And I look back at my dad and he's just like, he knew it, man. Great series, great film. I mean, I haven't kept up with all the new stuff. I mean, the Disney Plus series and things like that. I thought Mandalorian was really awesome, but so much content now has come out. It feels like Marvel to me. There's a lot going on. So I kind of like to pick the parts of the universe that I, you know, really enjoy. And I like the style of Mandalorian a lot. The new series. I'm a big fan of the new films too, you know? So, I mean, the whole Star Wars mythos, one of the original films to do it when it comes, you know, to sci-fi. I mean, they broke major ground on special effects, inventing completely new cameras. And even for a while, when I was studying computer science, one of my professors, he was big time into Star Wars, and a whole portion of his class, we studied the history of computing. And studying how Star Wars was shot and filmed was a key piece of that. Because, I mean, completely technology and software had to be developed to, you know, get the effects that they wanted. They were really doing something totally different. I mean, go watch 2001 Space Odyssey and then go watch Star Wars. I mean, the difference in special effects are immediately noticeable. No shade to 2001 Space Odyssey. Stanley Kubrick was a genius. And a true visionary, but I can't say that movie is necessarily a pleasure to sit down and watch. Star Wars, though, is a good old fun one, man.
Lucasfilm is talented. Stanley Kubrick may be talented, too, because there's a lot of theories out there that he made a movie about the moon landing. Everybody, you know, we may or may not have gone. I don't know who to believe. Like, I don't want to really believe that's a lie, but there's some interesting theories floating around out there about that.
I dare anybody to try to put that forth to a film student. You know, the funny thing is the way the story goes is that, you know, there was a studio that, you know, NASA approached to say like, hey, you know, we really got to do this moon landing thing. We don't know if we can really get there. So they set up the budget for how they would fake it and they laid it all out and just determined that it would just be cheaper to film it on site.
Well, apparently there's a movie coming out about that story, about how they filmed it, and theories about that too. But anyway, man, we wanted to go down that rabbit hole. That's for another.
I love conspiracy theory podcasts because they can be fun, man. Conspiracy theories can definitely be fun to talk about. Sometimes I think the truth of the moon landing is far more horrible. You know, the idea of strapping a couple humans onto the end of the exploding rocket, blasting them off into space. I mean, that's scary stuff, man. So
now about the Acolyte thing. So worst ratings of all time, shocker, right? We went way too far outside of left field with that one. And I just saw a video, Star Wars Theory reported on it. They even removed every piece of Acolyte merch from the Disney store. So somebody's in trouble, man. They wasted like $180 million budget. And then you got to count how much more money they lost than just $180 million. Because I know a ton of people, including myself, that canceled their Disney Plus subscription, didn't even finish the show. So they lost a lot more than $180 million.
I did watch a couple episodes of Acolyte. And I was honestly just really surprised with what I was seeing. Because, you know, the series Andor was so well done,
yeah,
and definitely like a love letter to, you know, Star Wars fans that like a very certain aesthetic, which I too, you know, really enjoy. I mean, all of the Force mythos and everything in Star Wars, I mean, that's interesting, but I always kind of like the people who are doing the Han Solos, right? The guys and the gals that are out there doing it without the Force, or maybe they got a little bit of it. That's why I said, like, I mean, with the Star Wars series, I really like Mandalore. You know, I feel like Jon Favreau getting involved in that. I mean, he clearly is really committed to kind of like the Star Wars lore. Acolyte just kind of felt like a fanfic, man. It really just kind of felt like I was watching a fan-made story, and they were just making a lot of broad sweeping decisions about, you know, things that are and aren't canon. And, you know, I've been kind of seeing a lot more of a trend. I mean, also kind of too in the Marvel world of people kind of moving away from what it is that made individuals really fall in love with the series originally. You know, I think people, they want to watch a fantasy story because they want to escape from the reality that they're in, the politics that surround them, the day-to-day socioeconomic, you know, this and that that's going on. I mean, sure, there are plenty of fantasy films that do excellent meta commentary on that. But I always just personally found Star Wars to be about fun. And there's definitely politicking in Star Wars. There's an empire and a rebellion.
Yeah, yeah.
I get it. But I just really like to get in and enjoy myself. That's kind of what like Mandalorian felt like. Good old Western, you know, good old Western gunslinging, running around, you know, a little references to Jabba the Hutt. I thought that stuff was really cool. Acolyte, though, on the other hand, you know, that's kind of a studio just taking it too far with trying to squeeze every bit of money out of everything they can, trying to hit as much of an audience and even like introduce new people to, you know, they're like, oh, this story is going to introduce new people to the Star Wars fandom. I don't get that mentality. If you're not into Star Wars by now, you don't like it. What's wrong with that? You know, not everyone is going to like, you know, the content you produce. So I think Disney is just... I hope they figure it out, but I think, you know, they made Galaxy's Edge and that park and everything, and they really started going in with trying to make maybe a little bit too much content, you know. Bring it back. We should bring it back to the classics is all I'm saying, man. You know?
Yeah, yeah, bring it back. What's Luke's story, you know? What's Kira's story? So the fan base is super loyal, right? They're not happy with it right now, but it'll eventually come back. I'm not worried about it. That pendulum will swing, and
definitely,
that'll be some good stuff coming back. Andor season 2 is probably going to crush it. Anything Tony Gilroy. Is the Gilroy brothers are involved in. The writing is just, it's on another level. It's definitely. On a whole nother level. So,
I think studios are definitely learning that, you know, you need to be tapping individuals, you know, who care a lot about the content and are very committed. And I mean, in a weird way, educated,
you know,
a lot on it because these sagas, man, your father watched. I mean, I'm talking about my father introducing me to Star Wars back in the 90s, man. That story is playing out over and over again, even today. It's a little bit of a sacred torch to carry, and it shouldn't be just put into anyone's hands trivially, man. You know, I mean, I think that there are definitely people that have put it forward and done some really interesting things with it. I mean, I think all the movies have really crushed it. I'm a big fan of anything in Star Wars that's come out in theater. I mean, even the Solo series and even like Rogue One, the movies they made that aren't a part of like the, you know, 9 movie series that they got going on. Those are dynamite. I love them. You know, so
me too.
I love them.
Yeah, me too. Agreed. Agreed on all points. All right. We'll talk about software engineering here.
For sure. Man. You give me your movies. I'll keep going. We can go to Marvel. Talk about Deadpool Wolverine. You know what I'm saying? So.
I'd start a movie commentary, you know, Disney commentary podcast on the side. So let me give you a chance to chat about your story. I know you're an ECU grad. My dad went there. He's not a computer science degree, though. He's an insurance guy. But, yeah, how'd you decide to go into software engineering? And tell us about your journey.
Wow, man. You know, I got very, very lucky because, you know, I had a pretty supportive family that actually bought me a personal computer and let me have one in my room when I was in high school. You know, I graduated high school 2006. So, you know, in that era, having your own computer or whatever to toy around on was, I mean, a bit of a rare item. And, you know, it was really prompted by one day I was sitting in band class, you know, next to one of my buddies, and we're selecting classes for the next semester. And I see computer science written on there. And I was a big video game buff at the time. I was helping some people working on a Warcraft 3 game mod. Some people may know it, some people not, but it's called Dota. If Defense of the Ancients, the original mod, like from way back in the day, testing it. And I was kind of like, I want to be a game developer, a game tester. That's what I, you know, kind of wanted. And my buddy went, computer science, they teach you to make video games in that class. I mean, that's all she wrote. All right. Now, we didn't make any video games, but what I did get introduced to is a world that I did not know existed. You know, my family were full of construction workers. I mean, my grandma worked at the Lee & Myers cigarette factory in downtown Durham. Like before that, I mean, we've been North Carolina natives doing non-technical work for a while. Now, you know, my father, he's got a background in electrical engineering. So, I mean, he was the one that bought me the computer because once he was like, oh, you know, this, you know, if my son, if he likes software and engineering, I know that software engineering is a thing. So with a little exposure to computer science in high school, you know, luckily because there was an NC State professor that had offered his time to teach like two or three computer science classes at my high school, you know, all because he had done that, I got exposed to this world that's like, you get to play with Legos all day, but like not just any kind of Legos. You can in any moment invent any shape Lego that you want, any color Lego that you want, you can instantly make it. And then you can make an infinite number of those Legos and do anything. So the only limitation that I had when I was building something was just my own imagination. How far could I go? How long could I tank it? You know, I never ran out of paint. I never ran out of ink. So we started making like really basic stuff. I mean, like calendar applications, dealing with things like leap years and stuff like that. And I mean, that really kind of sparked my interest into actually pursuing a degree, you know, at university. So, I mean, I was a C student, man. I wasn't really driven by academics. I liked math a lot and I made A's in math, but English, you know, not really my strong suit. History, not really my strong suit. So I wanted to kind of pick a university that would accept a guy like me, which is just a regular, not on a roll kid, looking to learn a little bit about computers. And I mean, that passion really drove me to push myself even harder at an academic level. And, you know, I did end up graduate from ECU with honors. And for a while there, worked in their IT department, helping graduate students and undergraduate students host websites and, you know, deal with the system's web servers and their IT systems. And then from there, started an internship with a company that was a consulting agency that worked in the oil and gas industry, of all things. I just kind of like fell backwards into it, but I was writing Java code, building web applications. Eventually that pivoted into Ruby on Rails. And that was kind of like 2011 when Ruby on Rails was really taken off. That framework and language and community that Ruby on Rails had around it kind of was acted like a magnet that drew me towards, you know, the startup industry. So, you know, after about 5 years of kind of doing, you know, the big company consulting thing, I mean, working with firms like IBM, Chevron, Exxon, going up to Alberta, Canada, pitching condition-based maintenance software and super enterprise stuff, you know, eventually I got hooked up with an agency based in downtown Durham called Smashing Boxes. And, you know, their founders and, you know, all their leaders there were really keen on having a spirit of entrepreneurship, helping the startup community, identifying really cool projects and building them out to be fully realized. I joined along for that ride and it was really great. And I kind of decided that I wanted, you know, really even more of that. And the CEO at the time was really encouraging when I told him like, you know, hey man, you know, I want to strike on my own. I have an aspiration to be like a CTO of a company or, you know, a lead technologist at a company. You know, I can't do that staying inside of an agency forever. So, you know, he was like, well, you should start, you know, start your own freelancing operation. I'll be your first customer. And I was like, how easy is that? I mean, like, you know, what an encouraging like endorsement, you know, to tell someone you're going to resign for them. And then they immediately hire you back on contract, man. I mean, he was like, do it. You know, you should absolutely do it. Don't let me get in your way. If anything, let me help you. So that was about 8 years ago. And, you know, I've been working as an independent contractor for a variety of different startups all over the triangle ever since. You know, most recently, I've been working for a while with a company here in the area called VTestify, and they build digital court reporting software for the legal industry, you know, that incorporates like document editing and video conferencing. That really took off during the pandemic and has taken off in even a bigger way with, you know, the new evolutions of AI. My story is one of learning, man. Constant learning, one language to another, one discipline to another. And that's what I really like about technology, man, is, I mean, you absolutely cannot get bored if you're going to be a software engineer. There is always something new coming out for you to learn, a new practice, new language, new discipline. Even today, I mean, I'm currently working my way through all of the Golang exercises on exorcism.org. Every year I try to pick up a new programming language. I may not use them professionally, but I always learn something new from them. So Golang's been a lot of fun. But professionally, for me, I just really like working with small companies, startups, greenfield projects, and taking them from just a basic idea or a simple MVP to a fully realized commercial product at scale with customers running on them, generating revenue, which, you know, is the goal of any business, right? We have to make money to continue onwards. And that's always a fun challenge that I like to get into, you know, a lot as well with small businesses that sometimes get a little lost along the way. They lose sight of, you know, what things they build that really drive their revenue, what keeps their business up and stable. So technical challenges, human challenges, you know, all these things and stuff that I really like, you know, working with. And I've been doing it now for, I mean, almost going on about 14 years now, I think, professionally. So, you know, looking forward to like 14 more, man. You know, I mean, I can't ever see myself being in a job where I'm not writing code, at least like once a week, I hope, you know, maybe not every day. You know, I don't know how long I can keep it up. You know, you got to be sharp to stay on the game. So
yeah. Well, if you love it and you're willing to adopt new technologies as they come up, like you're talking about Go seems to be gaining a lot of popularity.
Oh yeah.
One of the guys I follow, Daniel Meisler, big into AIs. He's built some really cool tools. One of them's called Fabric, and they just ported the whole thing over into Go. And he's like, oh man, so much faster. So, But then I was watching something else about Rust. It was a comparison of Go and Rust and the advantages and disadvantages of the two. And it seems like Rust may be faster, maybe a lot faster, but more of a pain in the ass to even deal with, right?
I think any Rust developer you talk to, man, would probably echo your sentiment right there. I mean, Go as a language is far more approachable. What I really like about Go is it's giving software engineers the ability to write really low level, high performant code that's memory safe. When you write code in C, and in C++, you're accessing, you know, the computer's memory space directly, and you can do anything you want at any time. And this is where we get really, really crazy cybersecurity issues going on, especially when you start working on software that is in healthcare, you know, is dealing with patients' lives. A lot of C and C++ applications out there, while they are secure, the language itself, it just doesn't lend to an experience that a lot of engineers expect these days, which is a more modern practice of, you know, managing your memory in a safe way. And having stuff like that baked into the language as opposed to just being practices, you know, that you're taught out of a textbook. It's like, hey, make sure you define your variables this way to be safe. This stuff is more enforced by Go and even more so by Rust too. I would say between the two, I do like Rust more. Rust has a compiler that like is absolutely brilliant. I mean, it will tell you immediately if you're missing a semicolon at the end of the line, and it'll like point directly where it's at, man. I mean, it is the syntax for Rust is definitely a little verbose and a lot to deal with, but there is a huge payoff when it comes to security and stability of your application and memory safetiness, which is something now, I mean, even the White House and I mean, the NSA is publishing documents over languages that they consider to be memory safe. And I mean, companies that are trying to go for like FedRAMP and take their application and deploy it inside of government space, they're going to have more of a burden now, prove and showcase, you know, what the language is written in. You know, I don't think we're there yet, but I think we're on the way to people saying like, you need to think about utilizing a different language, one of these memory safe ones that we've identified. And thankfully the list that, I mean, like the NSA put out recently, Go and Rustlang were right up at the top. And those are two languages that I really love. I'm also a big believer in picking the right tool for the problem. If I was going to build a little helicopter and it needed software in it so I could run the controls and fly it, maybe I'd pick Rust. But if I was going to build like a web API, maybe I wouldn't pick Rust. Maybe I'll pick Go, just because like the language and the technology around it lends to different locations. You know, I see a lot of people doing Rust with like embedded programming. You know, I hope no Rust programmers get up in the comments and start ripping me up being like, Brandon, you're wrong. You can use Rust for a lot of cool different things. So what I'm saying is not necessarily fact. It's just how I feel about the languages. Recently, I've just been doing more work with Go because I work more in the web world. That's really my thing. Almost everything that I do, a web server is involved in some way. You know, that's why my, you know, attention towards Golang has been, you know, the key thing for me recently.
What is your favorite programming language and what do you love and what do you hate about it? Is it Go or is it Ruby?
Ruby is my number one favorite language. You know, I still say it to this day. One of my favorite things about Ruby is it is exceptionally effective when it comes to like readability. It is very easy to read Ruby code and immediately understand what it's doing. So, you know, I very much like that whenever I come into a system and I'm looking at Ruby code, it reads like plain English. I enjoy that a lot. However, the thing that Ruby really suffers from is it's had concurrency issues, you know, in the past. That's more of a thing that's been sort of fixed up. But without a doubt, people have really identified Ruby as being a language that is not uber performant. And so it's kind of lost its shine a little bit as we come through the years, and Python has become a bit more dominant in terms of, you know, Python and Ruby are like brother and sister languages. They're both like, you know, they're interpreted languages. They're not compiled. They have similar quirks and oddities. Python is really coming out, you know, on top because of all of the amazing AI machine learning libraries that are built around it, like TensorFlow and PyTorch and tools like that. I mean, they're comparable ones in Ruby. It is definitely more of a weaker part of the language, but I've been building web technologies and web APIs in Ruby for quite some time now. One of the things that I always kind of like bring up with people is when we talk about not fast enough, what are we talking about? Are we talking about shaving off whole seconds or milliseconds? You know, before you whip out Rust and build an entire web API for your startup of zero customers, you know, maybe pick a language that, you know, you can develop and iterate really quickly in, and then identify the pieces that need to be optimized and utilize different languages to run things in an optimized manner, because Ruby is a really fantastic language. I love it a lot. I wish more people would pick it up and use it. The web development world is weird. I think JavaScript mainly is the big reasons, though, also why Ruby isn't as dominant as it used to be. It's very easy to pick up JavaScript and build front-end and back-end technologies in it. And if you are building front-end, you absolutely are using JavaScript. I mean, that is the language that I write 90% of my software in these days is going to be JavaScript. I like JavaScript. It's okay. I can't say it's my favorite language ever to work in. I feel forced to work in it in a certain way. You know,
use TypeScript.
I do use TypeScript. I like TypeScript. I mean, I've got my own personal opinions about TypeScript, which I'll say are, you know, I just like to write in plain JavaScript. I like to write in the same language that runs on the browser. So basic vanilla JavaScript has been my thing. I've been down these paths of using Dart, CopyScript. I've used plenty of JavaScript transpiled languages. TypeScript has definitely kind of like solidified itself as like a bit of a dominant space. So, I mean, I've done plenty of work with TypeScript, but if you told me, you know, hey, you get to pick a preference, Brandon, I will go back to saying, I just like straight up JavaScript. It's what I enjoy. I don't like to add extra syntax inside my JavaScript that then I open up my element inspector and it's not all there unless I like set up all my source maps correctly and this and that. So TypeScript, I definitely get it. I understand why people are, you know, they really, really like it. But right now, it just seems really popular to have strongly defined static types for everything in computer languages at the moment. When I came onto the scene, like 2010, that was like not cool. You know, that it was like, no, types are bad. You know, Ruby has duck typing. Everything is, if it quacks like a duck, then it is a duck. Just because you like that doesn't mean it's necessarily a good idea. It's all I say. And I think a lot of software engineers, me included, I've kind of started to say, yeah, maybe strongly typed languages can be really effective when you're, you know, talking about a massive company with millions of lines of code and you're looking at a function that was written 5 years ago and you're trying to go, all right, does this thing take in a number or like a string? I'm really not sure. You know, that's kind of the problems you'll deal with if you're ever writing Ruby. You'll be like, all right, so this function, this method, does it, you know, does it take in a string or is it, is it anything? What's going on here? It's a little hard to tell when you're working with Ruby. You just got to like see how it works as opposed to just like reading it directly. So the war rages on, I think, as always in computer programming, man. You know, do you want types? Do you not want types?
It's always it's changing all the time. Yeah. I mean, every year there's like almost something new introduced that you're like, oh man, that's going to start showing up on the job descriptions now.
Yeah, man. I mean, that's why that you get. Yeah. That's why as a software engineer, you got to be ready to be always be learning. Always.
Yep.
I tell people that if you're thinking about entering into this industry and you do not like learning,
it's not a good idea.
Yeah.
Now, if you were going to start fresh learning software development right now in 2024, where would you start?
I mean, I have a baked answer really to that question because so many people ask that of me. And I always say, what do you want to build? What is it that you want to build? Now, I will say, though, if what you want to build is just a piece of software that a bunch of people will use, I often say the browser should be your deployment target. Building interactive applications in the browser means that you don't have to go through a marketplace. You don't have to request that people download a custom piece of software onto their phone, computer, what have you. Your application is accessible on every single platform on the planet because everyone supports the internet and has a web browser on their computer. And if they don't, I would love to see what kind of computer that is. If it was at least built before 2000, you know, don't go pull up an old computer or anything like that. I mean, I'm sure, but I always tell people, like, you know, if you want to build a game, make it in the browser. Build a simple game in the browser. Don't try to make your first ever project being, I'm going to remake Stardew Valley. If you want to remake Stardew Valley, pick C. Or, you know, I'm not a game developer, but please pick a language that game developers use. But if you're just trying to build a game and learn programming at the same time, build tic-tac-toe. Do it in JavaScript. Put it on the browser. And then send it to your friend so that they can play it and then show you all the bugs that you accidentally coded into your system. Like, you know, the accidental ability to play over someone else's move or whatever. It's just, don't let yourself get bogged down by really complex delivery targets. Just start with something really simple and clean on the browser and use JavaScript. It is a language that can be utilized on pretty much anything. I'm just a big fan of that because I'm a big fan of picking up a language with the intention to build a thing. If your goal is to pick up a language with the intention to get a job in a specific industry, I don't think that's a bad idea. I just don't have a lot of advice for it because my thing was, like, back to my Lego analogy. I like building Legos. I like building things. I like people to ooh and ah at the stuff that I build. And I just found that the easier way to get my work in front of other people's eyes was to get it out there on the web browser. JavaScript is the only language, asterisk on that statement, but JavaScript is the only language that will run natively in the browser. So if you pick that up, you'll also be able to write backend code. You can use Node.js. You can even drop down to even lower level stuff as you know learn more and more. And you are going to have a massive wealth of knowledge out there that you can learn from. There are so many educational resources about JavaScript coming out there these days. And I would definitely say start there, you know, and then maybe think about picking up stuff like TypeScript. I mean, I'm just a big fan of learn the language first, then learn all the additive stuff that's around it. You know, don't just go to learn React. Don't just try to learn Next.js. Learn JavaScript. Then go pick up all the other auxiliary libraries that are around that.
Good advice. Amen. Would you recommend newbies get into development in 2024, or should people start to choose a different career path because of AI, you think?
I think right now software development is in a very, very, very strong position. You know, software engineering is still an extremely, extremely viable career. The situation with AI, what I think we've got going on right now is just another evolution in how software engineers are going to build software systems and write code. Before I started doing this professionally in 2010, in the 90s, you wrote code in a text pad. And even before that, my mother-in-law who worked, I mean, as a computer programmer, she did the punch card programming. You used to have to type into a machine that would print out pieces of paper that had holes in them and you would feed them into this machine. I can't even explain it to you because I'm so unfamiliar with the approach. Even though I'm like a 14-year seasoned software engineer, if you put me in a time machine and just sent me back into the past about 10 years, I'd be useless. I would be useless. The reason why is because I've gotten so used to all of the tooling that I have around me and the constant evolution of languages. You know, we talk about how C is not a memory safe language And then we learn a lot of abstractions and things like that. And we build Rust. And then something will come then next beyond that. I mean, the software engineering discipline, it's very, very young. I often like to make the claim that it is the youngest industry that's out there. You know, I'm sure that people could debate me on that, but there was really no such thing as being a software engineer in like the 40s. But if you want to talk about like building buildings and architecture, that's been around since like the Great Pyramids. You know, I mean, it's a very young discipline. It is definitely still really healthy. But what I think is really happening with the AI stuff is we're seeing another evolution of tooling that is going to help us a lot with writing code. I use GitHub Copilot every single day, and I would say it has greatly increased my performance. Now, I don't work on the weekends. I don't have to pull 12-hour days. My work gets done much faster. And, you know, the expectations of my clients, I mean, yes, they increase with that, but I get to spend more time now doing the things that I really love about software engineering, which is thinking about concepts. So much of my work just happens in my brain without my hands on my keyboard at all. I had many mentors, you know, through my life that will often tell me, like, Brandon, if you're struggling with a problem, get up from the keyboard and go have a walk and go, you know, walk around in the forest. That's kind of where I learned, like, some of my most valuable work happens in those moments. But then you have to sit down and do what I call hand jamming on the keyboard. You got to twist your fingers up and get all these characters in this really certain order. You got to write this for loop. You got to do this, you know, recursive statement and all these things. You can now with Copilot kind of write a good portion of the function and it just starts auto-completing. And I just refer to it as like one of the best auto-completes I've ever seen in my life. Before, you know, I started working with Copilot on a daily basis, I was hitting tab to do really basic function autocomplete stuff, which a lot of people had seen that. And then before that, Java developers, they've used Eclipse, which will like straight up tell you what the next function is that you should write. And you kind of hit tab and you autocomplete, you build these snippets out. But you had to like be really good at configuring your dev environment to get all that value. Now AI can come in and just look at the code base and start providing that value to engineers right out of the gate. I mean, even students and university are going to benefit from this. And I think, you know, one of the big things that I hope comes out of this is more companies have access to the ability to build custom software. I say to people all the time, you know, why are you building, you know, that really janky web page? You could just make yourself a little, you know, script in Excel to do a thing. Now people can go to systems like ChatGPT, maybe even Copilot and Microsoft. I've never used that before, but, you know, recommending functions inside of Excel docs, like people are coding is becoming a skill that people are learning and just having as a side effect of like jobs that they have, like writing cursive, you know, that used to be considered like a skill that everyone kind of had to dabble in a little bit. I think coding needs to be that now. I've been a proponent of saying like as young as like second grade, kids should be sat down and they should be in a computer class writing code. And by writing code, I probably don't literally mean characters on a screen. There are visual coders like Scratch. And then who knows what AI could come out with, you know, I mean, an AI powered visual coding tool for kids just to teach you basic concepts like a loop and an if statement. I mean, that's really, really good knowledge for anyone that wants to work in the economy of the future, which is, I mean, I think still going to be very technology, very software driven. I'm a big believer in AI, man. And I'm a big, big, big proponent of, you know, continuously saying it's called Copilot, not autopilot. It is an assistive tool. And GitHub is very, very upfront about that whenever they talk about Copilot. And I would say the analogy fits very, very well. It is like having an assistant sitting right next to me all the time that is sometimes they'll just type on my computer for me, but without all the awkwardness of having to deal with another person. The AI always agrees with me.
Right. Yeah. And you can program it to have the personality of TARS.
Yeah, man. You know, maybe like, I mean, that would kind of be my next dream is if I could like actually have a verbal conversation with it about a coding concept and I can be like, oh, I'm thinking about making a, you know, a function that'll do this and that and this and that. And it could like spit out a little pseudocode for me. I mean, I welcome that future. I want to get away from having to break my fingers. I've seen engineers actually suffer from carpal tunnel. I mean, it just the amount of typing on the keyboard that happens to write software, that is the ultimate limiter, in my opinion, when it comes to bandwidth of output for technology companies, is legitimately the amount of time it takes to get the idea out of my head, in my hands, onto the keyboard, and then running with reasonable code in the computer. If I could just speak my ideas out and then tweak the outputted code to do exactly the way that it is that I want, and even if I could tweak it by having more verbal conversations, that would be awesome. And then on top of that, I also don't want that to be a verbal experience, so it doesn't bother like my wife and family here at the house, and I got to talk out loud like this. Maybe if you could just read my mind. Can we get to that? Can AI do that yet?
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. Don't abandon software engineering for sure. I think it's going to be kind of like you said, right? It's going to be a skill set that you kind of need on the side. Everyone's going to benefit from knowing at least a little bit, enough to be dangerous to, you know, take advantage of some of the automation and AI that make yourself more productive. There's a tool that I want to try to learn how to use. It's called Fabric that the guy Daniel Meisler created. And because I'm a YouTube junkie, I'm just always watching stuff on YouTube, and a lot of it's just stuff I'm like, get 10 minutes in and I just next, turn off. But I've got a pretty lengthy watch later list. Well, he's got a tool where you can just plug in the YouTube URL and it will tell you what the value density of the content is. I think it's called wows per minute or something like that. And it'll score, and just like super fast, it'll score the video. It could be hours long, and it'll kind of give you a rating whether it's worth your time or not. And I'm like, hey, I kind of need that. I need to learn this tool.
That sounds like a really cool tool, because YouTube has gotten into a really, really, really weird space, man. You know, I have to sit through about 3 minutes of you pitching your merch line and your sponsors and your intro and all that before I actually get to the meat of the content. And even then, I just kind of miss the days of, you know, people just screen recording and they're not even talking. They're just typing text into a notepad on the screen. I mean, that's how YouTube was when I was learning how to code and watching Learn to Code videos. It was just a guy screen recording his Windows XP or Vista desktop, open up Notepad and type. Today, we're going to learn how to write a for loop in C and, you know, just put some music on or whatever. Now, though, it is, hey, the expectation of, you know, content, it's gone up and up and up. And now you got to have some sponsors if you want to pay for that nice camera and that dynamite lighting and maybe pay that editor that's got to, you know, be editing all of your content together and stuff. I mean, YouTube is serious business now these days. It's not just a little video website anymore. People are picking up entire careers now by watching videos on YouTube. I mean, I appreciate when companies like Zoom, for instance, I've become very involved recently, learning a lot about Zoom APIs and Zoom integration and trying to build Zoom apps. And they have an excellent repository of resources in the form of videos on their YouTube page, up to date, professionally produced. I really like that. That's really cool that a technology company would go about doing that, because that helps with learning. Listen to it on my run. Go for a jog, put the AirPods in. Be, you know, kind of be on your way, you know, just get the audio piece of it, or, you know, watch in the background while you're doing something else, put it on your phone and jump on a treadmill at the gym. I mean, I do a little bit of that. You know, I'm a multitasker. I like doing that stuff. So
always, always listen to something. If I'm not making a phone call, I'm listening to something. So, and not to derail a little bit, but I'm curious, are you a Mac guy or a PC?
I mean, I've got a PC back here that I mean, this is my old school streaming setup, and then the computer that I'm on back here, you know, here is a Mac. When it comes to my work day to day, I do work all the time on MacBook. The reason for that is mainly because, you know, when I was at university, if you wanted to have a Unix powered machine that ran like Bash and the same like Linux style kind of like architectural stuff that was going to run on a web server, sure, you could get a Linux laptop. But, you know, I felt like I was swimming against the current, man, in university. I mean, I was working hard. So, you know, my parents were, to my request, to get me a MacBook. It was extremely expensive at the time. So, I mean, that's a huge blessing to be able to have access to, like, doing something like that. But it kind of put me on this track for web development, because at the time, everyone was like LAMP stack. And the L in LAMP is Linux. And Mac has a, you know, I mean, underlying, when you open up the terminal, it's extremely similar to a Linux environment. So for that reason, and also because I've picked up doing mobile application development, which like you sort of have to build your mobile apps on a MacBook due to licensing things now. Because of that, I've been pretty much a loyal MacBook Apple person forever, man. But I'm you know, my gaming rig obviously is a PC. I'm a big gamer. I'm on the PC. I'm on Discord a lot, hanging out with my boys, playing the latest game that came out. So the PC's for fun. The Mac is for work. And I feel like that helps me a lot because it gives me like this mental barrier. When I'm looking at a Mac UI, my brain's in business mode. And then when I'm looking at my Windows UI, I'm back in play mode. So, you know, I do a little bit of balancing of both. You can get yourself a Linux laptop running Ubuntu, no problem. You know, I mean, it used to be a nightmare whenever I was trying to do it, but and I really wanted a laptop. But now I really encourage people, if, you know, you're looking to get into software development and you can't afford that like $3,600, $1,800 MacBook, I mean, they're expensive. And there's a reason for that. You can pick up some very, very affordable Ubuntu. And I you know, I'm a big fan of the Ubuntu flavor of the Linux operating system. Ubuntu just pre-installed, you know, on the computer. You can pick these up for like, you know, even $400. You know, I would definitely encourage somebody, if you're looking to get into web application development in particular, you know, look at getting yourself a Linux computer. I'm a big believer in it. I will go back that it's really all about what you're doing. If you're building video games, you're pretty much going to be on a Windows computer. Full stop. That's just how it's going to be. And I think it's all about the deployment target, really, at the end of the day. What's your software going to run on? That's what you should be working on. For me, though, it runs on the browser. So I get a little freedom, but I got to use both environments, man, because the browser is on Windows and Mac. Thankfully, these days, we don't really have to test on two operating systems anymore. Back in the day, you had to check it on every machine. Now, with so much tooling we got out there, I don't have to do that anymore. I just only work on my MacBook.
Do you use, a productivity tool called Alfred or Raycast?
Yeah, I use Alfred. It is kind of like the spiritual successor to a tool called Quicksilver, which was very popular back in the day. You know, you can write these custom command keystrokes to automatically pop up applications for you. But my day-to-day workflow really is I have a hotkey that opens up Alfred, and it opens up a window on your desktop that you just start typing in text. And I just type in what application I want open. That even goes all the way to my phone. I have zero apps on my home screen on my phone. My home screen is totally blank. I pull down Spotlight and type in the name of the app that I want to open up. I don't know why I started doing that, man. I don't know why. The person who really got me on that was a buddy of mine. I mean, he actually works at Apple now, and he showed me he uses his iPhone like that. And I was like, no way. And I started doing it, and I was like, oh, man, like having a blank home screen. Now I don't do that muscle reaction thing when you touch your phone and then you immediately unlock it and then you immediately click the place on your phone that has Instagram. You know, this like I was able to stop this like kind of unhealthy behavior that I was getting into of just like always touching my phone and immediately opening up the same app. And my brain is like, wait, I don't even want to open Instagram. I was just trying to check my text messages. Like, what am I doing? Now I'm on social media all of a sudden, you know? So maybe Alfred kind of inspired that a bit. But I mean, when it comes to like my day-to-day work, man, I love those. Like, I like to tell my computer what I want. That's how I like to work with it. So I tell it, open Chrome. I don't like to alt-tab around until I find the Chrome application and then it brings it. Like searching around for stuff, I don't like that. I like to tell my computer exactly what I want, and then I like for it to then give me that thing that I want. And I do the same thing with my text editors too. When I want to open up a file, I don't search and scroll through a file tree till I find the file and then click on it to open it. I open the quick find window and type the first couple characters of the file name or what I think the file is called. And then I open up the first thing that it is that comes to me. That's been a big piece of like my workflow. I picked that up probably through years of just working with other software engineers. This like mentality that people have of like tell, don't ask or something like that. You know, I don't know. Like I'm making demands of my computer, you know? So.
Yeah. No, I like that. I need to look into it. There's a Windows based version that I researched called Curiosity, and they're still working on that.
You know, I mean, I'm a fan of like workflow optimizations like that, man. You know, I mean, I feel like that if you spend 30 seconds every single day doing a thing, if you can take that 30 seconds or just 5 seconds out, you can save yourself a whole hour. I don't know why. I just really, really love micro optimizations like that. And Alfred has like all these interesting like power packs that you can install and custom keystrokes you can make that, I mean, I've probably got like 50 plus of them that I've written at this point. It's all a totally custom thing that's just grown organically over the years of me using it. But yeah, Alfred, I can't endorse it enough. Big fan.
Yeah, I like the idea on your phone too, because you're right. You'll go to your phone for whatever reason it is, has nothing to do with social media.
Yeah,
but then you'll see the app there and you'll just click it.
Blank, man. No app.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's, just the top to the bottom, maybe a couple of those.
It's not a bad idea. I need to look into that. I wonder what the Android comparison is. They have a spotlight for Android?
Yeah, man. You know, I mean, I'm on Android. I mean, you can open up the app library or do a quick pull down and you can just start typing into the search and like you can. I mean, that's how like I turn on low power mode on my, you know, on my phone. I just pull down spotlight. I type in like low and it starts to pull up that portion of the settings and you click into like, you know, the hot help tip and you just go right into there. I have an Android phone as well because, I mean, the app that I maintain is a hybrid app. It's iOS and Android, and they have a similar thing. You can take all of your apps off your home screen, put them all into your app library, and then pull them up only when you need them. It is absolutely a couple more keystrokes, so I would not say that the phone thing is an efficiency measure that I took. I'm not going to claim that that's an efficient process, but it is efficient for me because I found myself constantly opening my phone and just muscle memory opening apps that I didn't even intend to open. And big distraction for me, man. I have ADD, you know, there it is.
Yeah. I think I'm slick by using all these folders, but then you realize like you've got your apps grouped together, but you forget where you put them whenever the folder gets crowded. So I don't think that's a good idea anymore.
Yeah.
It's like the idea of just typing in the name of the app that you know you're trying to get to in the same place every time. So good little hack there.
I've had races with my friends where they're like, no way, Brandon, I can open up Facebook faster than you. And I'm like, let's see it. And I've beaten them a few times, unless you got it like right there on your home screen. Like, yeah, you know, I can just type my phone super fast.
Yeah.
So it works for me. It's quick for me, but I don't know many people that do that.
So what are you focused on lately, man? Are there any issues that you're following closely or any projects that's like on the forefront of your mind right now?
Yeah. I mean, AI is always something of definitely of keen interest that's going on currently. You know, something that I've become really, just really interested in watching unfold in the technology space is, I mean, like the ever changing aspects of things that are happening in the cybersecurity industry. I think that people on all sides of the American government, in every political group, have all sort of agreed that technology is woven into the fabric of our society now. And the most dangerous thing that could happen to the country, a business, or what have you these days is a cybersecurity attack. It seems like now, every other week, there's a new hack, exploit, zero day, or data dump that's happened. I mean, recently, apparently all of our social security numbers are just like out there now. There are systems floating around out there that were built probably even in the late 90s, haven't been updated since, that are just like operating, holding private sensitive data, and they're getting exploited, and information is, your personal information is just being leaked out on the internet. And I mean, for you as a person, you may not feel like that damages you per se, but it definitely damages a business. Whatever you think about like leaking IP, a client list, an investor list, you know, what have you. I mean, you just kind of store this stuff willy-nilly in a non-secure space. You could put yourself at major risk. It seems like every year, hackers are getting more and more clever about how they enter into your security systems. And it seems like the tried and true tactic that has emerged out of all of them is not the hooded kid in a dark room behind a computer hacking into the matrix and breaking 256-bit key encryption. That's not what it is. Now it's the individual who social engineers you by sending you, I mean, they call this spear phishing now in, you know, the email world, where they will send a CEO a hyper-targeted email very keyed towards them. Maybe it's an invoice from an angry client with the exact same name as an actual client that the CEO knows. The email has been spoofed. Everything looks perfect. They click on that link. They download the invoice file. And just like that, you know, the notepad that they keep on OS X that has all their passwords in it, including the master password to AWS, has fallen into some, you know, notorious figure's hands, not through hacking, not through robust knowledge of technology. They didn't pierce your firewall. They just sent you a casual email. Social engineering as a tool for hackers has become like rampant. And not just in the analogy that I use too, but there was a really big event that sort of happened in the web development world that even took place before the whole CrowdStrike incident that happened in the summer here, 2024. Several months before that, a library called PolyfillJS, which was widely used across a lot of different web applications to essentially provide modern JavaScript functionality that may not currently be available in the browser at that current time. People were installing this library by dropping in a snippet of code into their application that says, okay, whenever someone loads up my website in their browser, go to polyfilljs.com and download the latest version of Polyfill and then run that code inside the browser. And, you know, that way I have all of the JavaScript, this and that, or, you know, all the Polyfill functionality that, you know, that I want. Well, that was an open source project that was maintained by an individual at not a lot of pay. The time came where, I mean, that person, they're maintaining it for free. They're not under any kind of grant. They just do it in their spare time. This library, it gets acquired by a company out of nowhere through, I don't even know the details, but like the events that played out was not a hack. Essentially, a Chinese company took over ownership of the PolyfillJS URL and, you know, the GitHub repository and just decided to take that URL and point it instead to a malicious site. Then now instead of your website downloading the Polyfill library, it downloads that and it redirects the user to a phishing website that is like, hey, we detected a virus, click this button to get a free scan. Or it just installs like some kind of browser level keylogger, you know, at a really low level, or it scans your cookies, or, you know, who knows what it does. This wasn't like a hack. This was just like a company acquiring an open source project that's really widely used by everybody and then just deciding to inject malicious code into it. You don't have to be a genius to do this. You just have to want to hack somebody. That's pretty much, you know, it. And then also have the ability to, you know, take over ownership of one of these libraries, which a lot of people will say, you know, Brandon, no maintainer would do that. Well, I can promise you this much. If you've been working with an individual online and have never met them in person for going on 2 years, and they're really, really super nice, and they've been helping you out a lot, 99% of the time, that's probably a genuine person that wants to help you out in open source, maybe 99.999% of the time. But that 0.001% of the time, when it's a malicious actor that's doing a long play to gain your trust so they can eventually take over maintainership of your project, that's a hack, you know? It's really, really interesting to me watching these things play out now. Just when I was in high school, man, I thought hacking was like the Matrix. You just like had to be super tech savvy. But now I'm learning like hacking, actually, the best hacks happen because you're really good at socially navigating, you know, the technical landscape. So all of these, I think, have raised some interesting new questions. I mean, for companies, for even the open source community at large, I mean, the CrowdStrike engines, we can definitely talk more about that. But I mean, everyone, I think, is well informed on the situation that happened there. And that's had companies, they're starting to go, wow, we saved thousands of dollars going with CrowdStrike for our cybersecurity needs. But now that's cost us millions of dollars. So it's a very, you know, just interesting thing I've been watching to play out. I'm not a cybersecurity expert myself. As a software engineer, I work with a lot of them and I know the kind of stuff they care about. And they are very big up on saying stuff like, don't have your password as a post-it note on your computer desktop. Don't literally just do that. They mean so much more than that. Also, maybe not a notepad, maybe get a password manager. Maybe make sure that password manager is like an encryption vault. Definitely of a big interest of mine and something that's been playing out, I feel like, through this year, man.
Yeah, I feel like it's going to be paramount importance to, you know, to bolster up cybersecurity. And it's really had an impact, I think, on company spend, because it seems to be there's been like a complete disappearance of the QA testing role. I used to fill a lot of QA tester and we are you manual? Are you automated? Are you a software engineer in tests? And I had this big script and like a screening spreadsheet where I was really good at placing folks who did test automation. And I haven't seen a role like that seems in years. And I feel like companies have basically reallocated all their spend that they were utilizing for QA testing. And now they've migrated all that over to cybersecurity. Are you seeing the same thing?
I mean, I can't speak too much towards the migration of funds from QA to cybersecurity, but I definitely can say, you know, QA is a discipline. It is of massive value, I feel like, the companies. QA is the department in your company that makes sure that your output is of the highest possible quality before it hits the customer. However, it just, in my experience, was always the lowest resource department in a company. It really hurts to see that, because that happens. And then I sit in meetings where executives go, how can we increase our output velocity? And I go, here's a pitch. Don't fix so many bugs. And they're like, what do you mean? And I'm like, catch the bugs before they go out with the QA team. Don't let your users report them and then end up with a 150 card long backlog of bugs. And then now your engineering team is splitting half time between making a product and fixing the bugs. You know, I always kind of get met with this reaction of like, well, why can't the engineers just QA their own work? That's like asking a chef to taste his own food. If you've ever worked in a kitchen, you would know that it is standard practice. If when it comes to tasting, the chef doesn't taste their own food. When you're cooking all day long, your senses are, you know, you're immersed in it. You're engrossed in it. And you may even lose the idea that what you're making could be bad. You could be like, this is good. What I am doing is good. Why else would I be doing it? But then you have to hand it off to someone that's going to give you an objective opinion. And, you know, when you lose those people in your business, you're putting yourself at risk. But now I think that maybe the funds, you know, flowing in the direction of cybersecurity is just a byproduct of a joke a friend of mine used to always tell me who worked in the security department, which is, you know how to get a company concerned about security and spending money on it? Well, you burn down the building next door. You know, that's how you get people to pay for fire insurance. I mean, that always resonated with me. It's like, you know, humans react most of the time. Humans react. They're not proactive. But, you know, the best business leaders are proactive. They foresee trends. They concern themselves with, you know, the potential of bugs or failures that could go out. And they implement a department inside their company that's going to be proactive at catching bugs. But at the same time, you also got to balance what's going on with cybersecurity. So, I mean, it's a tough problem, man. You know, I don't really have an answer for it. I mean, I really think that, as with all things in software engineering, I always like to go back to the same analogy. We're a young industry. We're always learning. The pendulum swings this way and it swings back to that way too. And I think that people are talking a lot about cybersecurity. When it comes to QA, I really do hope that that is a discipline that sticks around for a very long time in software engineering, because we need to be shipping good quality software to our customers. If we're shipping garbage, then people aren't going to hire us. They're not going to use our software. They're going to use someone else who is concerned with quality. However, let's make sure that the teeter-totter doesn't mean that that has to then balance out security. Like, I hate that it's like this one or the other type idea. You know, I feel like it should be everything. I'm a software engineer, man. If you talk to my CEO, and I talk to him all the time about this, he's like, Brandon, we have limitations, you know? And I get that. Businesses, they have limitations. You know, you got to put your money in the place that you feel like is best serving the customer. And, you know, you have to understand that there's going to be trade-offs to decisions that you make. So if you decide to invest more in security and less on QA, then you kind of need to be prepared for the payoff of possibly having your engineering team have lower velocity, and you're going to spend more money on engineering time. If you're going to invest more in QA and less in cybersecurity, then, you know, maybe you need to be prepared for the possibility of having fees levied against you whenever massive data breaches happen or you don't follow PCI compliance correctly. It's a huge challenge. I'm not going to sit here and be like, I'm a software engineer and I have all the answers for you. Spend money on everything. Like, there's my solution. Get more money, spend it on everything. Like, that's not a solution, right? We have limitations. I think everyone is really trying their best. I mean, they're constantly learning as they go. I feel like the cybersecurity stuff is definitely of keen importance, though, as per the events that have happened recently. I mean, through this year and even very, very recently, as of August here, you know, we're sitting here August 23rd, 2024, just like last week, you know, kind of got the announcement about the whole federal database that got leaked. These reports are constantly coming out. So I think it's top of mind right now for business owners. They're very concerned.
China's got our data. What are we going to do? They know that I work from home and don't do very much. there's
absolutely, I mean, I always tell people, you know, you're not being like a conspiracy theorist saying something like that or an alarmist. That is a factual thing that is absolutely going on. China's MO is to watch the US for as much IP as they possibly can. And I mean, take it. There's a big part of hacking is going into that. Another is in obtaining and taking data. And I'm also convinced that the US government is engaged in the exact same thing, as a matter of fact. But
they're the worst business,
and you're looking to shield yourself, don't be ignorant. Don't think that companies aren't attacking me. I'm not Facebook. No one's gonna attack me. These are automated attacks. These are botnet farms that are just running and attacking. They are casting a broad net. I have applications running out there that only have a couple thousand users and operate only here in the local North Carolina Triangle area. And that their website is constantly under attack all the time, always. Thank goodness I have Cloudflare and all these amazing firewall tools, though, that keep all the bad people out.
So are you partially like an application security engineer as well and a developer? Like, have you pretty much adopted the SaaS and DAS testing to your apps?
I mean, I wouldn't call myself like a application security engineer. I think that like security, though, is a really big part. You know, as an engineer, there are things that you just kind of need to know and do and be concerned with, and you can be concerned with it or you cannot, like storing passwords and plain text in a database. You know, someone makes an account on your website and they give you their email and they give you your password and you take that raw password and you save it into your database, you are operating unethically. That is not what you're supposed to do. But there are zero things in place and that's really preventing you from doing that. You can implement an authentication system like that. It's extremely insecure and very inappropriate to do and borderline unethical, in my opinion. I mean, forget borderline. It's unethical. You shouldn't do it. Your passwords have to be unidirectionally encrypted. You cryptographically turn into a big, long, gobbledygook string that can never be converted back to the password. And you utilize this methodology that, I mean, is well documented and well studied and practiced in software engineering to store passwords in a secure way inside of your database. So there are things like that I mean, I personally am, I think, learned on only just because, you know, I've had to pick it up. I imagine and I dream for a world where if someone was implementing authorization in a piece of software, you would have to do that. And not through regulation, not through oversight, just through the natural way that the implementation is. I don't have like a lot of great words to describe that. I just kind of like wish for one day for that to be the case. And it feels like we're getting closer and closer there every single day. You know, it's rare now that I come across an application where I've seen a junior developer save a password in plain text in a database. You know, it's like having an electrician just like twist two hot wires together. Maybe you get shocked enough times and you learn, but you know, it's kind of like, let's not shock ourselves at all. Right. Let's just have it cooked in and baked in to do that. But it's more of a hobby or interest, but I don't do a lot of things that, I mean, people in cybersecurity really get into, which is evaluating and auditing security practices. I don't do a lot of that, trying to infiltrate systems. You know, I'm more of a builder, but I work a lot, man, hand in hand with people who will come into my system and they are always teaching me new things, about how to make my software more secure. And, you know, I try to take that with me forever. It's an ever growing number of like defensive things that you need to do if you're going to make, you know, a web product, especially. So,
yeah, it's like playing whack-a-mole. There's just when you think you got your bases covered, a new one pops up and there's, you know, best practices. It's, you know, it's hard to kind of follow them all because there's so many things to consider. So It's like its own skill set, just knowing what the best practices are. It takes a senior developer that's made a lot of mistakes to even know that. But another thing that I've been seeing, though, I've seen like the market seems to be kind of falling out of love with the agile methodology. Have you seen that? And do you know if there's a reason behind that?
Yeah, man. I've actually had the pleasure of being friends with Andy Hunt, who's one of like, I mean, the original signees of the Agile Manifesto. And I mean, I've had him speak at meetups of mine and worked a lot with him. And I mean, him and I had a conversation years back where he said like, geez, Louise, like I sure do wish I did trademark Agile when we came up with this, because Agile is, it's not a process. It's a methodology. It's an idea of putting people over process. It's an idea of doing short iterative bursts of work and constantly seeking feedback. The idea being work for a week, show your friends what you made, ask for their feedback, and then go back and work on it, you know, some more. Don't work for 5 months in a closet and then come out with your product and showcase everything to everybody, because the needs of your customer might have changed, the industry might have changed, the whole world might have changed. You know, everything is changing around us all the time. So the spirit of Agile was to be agile, right? Like, I can move here, I can move there, I can adjust as the needs of my customer. You know, we're trying to hit a moving target when we're building software. I mean, at least this day and age. So I think a lot of companies took Agile and they put a capital A in front of it and they wanted to kind of slap a trademark on it. And a lot of people went, Agile is Scrum. That's really what I think is dying, is Scrum. The idea of these very regimented daily standups, very specific ways to write cards, velocity tracking, where you just assign arbitrary numbers. Well, this card's 5 blueberries. Well, this card is 10 pineapples. You know, this is a t-shirt size X, and this is an XL, and this is a medium. I think a lot of people have really kind of lost the shine on the whole like Scrum thing. And then you would have a Scrum master, which is like an individual on your team whose only job was to essentially like execute the Scrum process. All of this kind of got together and you lost people over process. You know, a person comes up and they sit there in a meeting and they go like, I don't know how many story points this card is. Like, I don't even know what to say. Like, you're asking me to, you know, spike a prototype of an entire iOS app. I don't know if it's 10 points. I don't know if it's 2 points. And the project manager, the Scrum Master, will twist that person's arm and go, you need to give me a number because that is our process. Because we put it into the burn down chart and then we turn that burn down chart into an Excel document. And then that's a line graph or a bar graph or whatever kind of graph that they think their shareholders really like. And then that ends up, you know, in the executive board later. And it's like, look how efficient our development team is. Check out the velocity. Look at the line. People are trying to like assign sales and currency related concepts, like profit and revenue going up and like accounting, and trying to do that with software. When I'm like, can you just sit those stakeholders down and just show them the thing you built, like the thing they paid for, or like a pitch of that? Like, that's what's really going on. We're not completing cards. We're building software. So I think like people have kind of started to lose their shine a little bit on Scrum, really. And a lot of people are just learning that Scrum and Agile, these aren't like the same thing. Scrum is like an implementation of Agile. You can do a Kanban board where you like pull cards off. You can do sprints. You cannot do sprints. If you are doing sprints, that does not mean you're Agile. If you are not doing sprints, that does not mean that you are not Agile. Sorry for the double negative, but I hope like my point comes across that just because you open up a Jira board and you do all this stuff, I mean, I encourage people, go back and read the Agile Manifesto. The goal of it was really to put humans first and put some like empathy into the development process. And first was understanding the needs of your customers. And then second was like understanding the needs of your team. And then merging those two things together so that, you know, you can have an efficiently operating team that's actually building the things that your customers and your stakeholders really want, not just a stand up with sprints and a velocity burn down chart. That's like, I don't think we're there yet, you know, in the software development, you know, discipline where we can have that level of insight into like progress of building a system. I don't think the tooling is there yet. I think the industry is a little too young, you know, and I think a lot of business owners, you know, they go, so the sales team generated $10,000 in revenue this year or this quarter. Sick. Show me how much velocity the engineering team generated. Like, that's, it's not like that. You're looking at the output of the sales team. Look at the output. That's, you know, I get it. If you want to look at the output of your engineering team, look at their actual output, not just a bunch of arbitrary points that a couple engineers just made up in a room while they were sitting there begging to get out of the meeting. I think that's why people are losing their shine on it. They realize it's inaccurate. It's not informative. It doesn't help.
What is the best way to measure? Because I feel like there's like highly productive developers that can work at 10x the speed of other developers, and they seem to get a ton of work and they like truly hit their WIP limit, work in progress limit. And then there's like the other devs who can like intentionally pretend that they've hit their WIP limit and they're like throttling their workload so that you know, it seems like it's a difficult story that they're working on. Maybe it's worth 10 blueberries, but really they're only working 4 hours every 2 weeks and mm-hmm. posting, you know, funny skits on Instagram, like a couple of them that I follow. So like, how do you measure the productivity of a developer?
I would say, you know, in this day and age, you yourself need to just have engineering experience. If you cannot open GitHub and watch the commits roll in and understand what that means for your business and, you know, the evolution of your product, then maybe you need to hire a technical co-founder that can, because it is absolutely a thing where, you know, if engineers feel like there's very little to no oversight on whatever it is that they're doing, and I don't think this is unique to development. This happens in all industries all over the world. They will absolutely tell you, I'm working so hard. And if you have no idea how to do what they do, you're just going to have to trust their word. And you need to make sure you hire some really, really trustworthy people if that's what you want to operate off of. As a business owner, you can make that decision. You can decide, I'm going to trust my engineering team. Well, then please make sure you're hiring trustworthy people if you're doing that. And I don't know how to measure someone's trustworthiness. What do you do? Put them up to a lie detector test, put them on, you know, put them on the stand and cross examine them. I don't know. What I found is really useful is having strong engineering leadership that has like equity stake in the company and really cares about the healthiness and success of the company. And if you have that, I've led teams of engineers as big as like 30 something people. I never had any issue opening up GitHub and looking at the projects and seeing, oh, this person has a committed code in 5 days. It's very obvious. That's like me walking out onto the factory floor and watching people work. I say, put eyes on it and make sure you have a partner that understands what it is that they're looking at. I mean, right now, building software is like producing code. So you can watch. You can also do this without needing to look at the repo by demanding demos every single week and watching that progress. And I think that's very, very helpful, but it's extremely hard to do at scale in a really large business, especially when your software is got to such a legacy state where it can take a month just to introduce a new piece of functionality. You know, the feedback loop isn't tight enough for that, right? You need to be able to identify problems and low performance in your business far before that happens. So, you know, I encourage people, make sure you have a technical co-founder that you trust a lot, that you're partnered with, really partnered with for real. Tell them this is something you're concerned about. Tell them, I want to make sure that every day developers are doing their job, because I'm going to be honest with you, man, I'm not sure what it is that you do, but that's why I've got you. You know, I know how to get the market. I know how to get the business. I know how to get investing. And I mean, CEOs, they do a lot. And I'm not asking them to do one more thing, because a lot of the CEOs that I know, I'm worried that I would melt their brain if I ask them to do one more thing, because they're always doing so much. You know, I always feel blessed to only have to work on the code. I always encourage, you know, any business owner, man, get yourself a technical co-founder, tell them you care about this. And to the technical managers, don't be squeamish at using version control and GitHub to get insight on what your engineering team is up to. I don't buy into the stigma that that's a form of micromanagement. I disagree. I believe that that's effective leadership. I believe that you will be able to identify when you have teammates that are struggling. You'll be able to see exactly what it is that they're struggling in. And sometimes people are just too scared to ask for help. And you will be able to notice and dive in preemptively, you know, before they do get so lost that they feel like they need to interrupt your flow to get help. I just think that coding is one of actually like the most transparent disciplines out there. I don't get why it is that so many companies operate in this way where they go, okay, I've got coders, I hope they're working. You know, they just look away. They go, oh, that's too complicated. It's too complicated for me. I'm too intimidated. Don't do that. You know, it's you know, you got into this business. If you want to have a finger on the pulse in terms of like, I mean, how productive people are, then please, I mean, get on it. And please, engineering leaders, require that your developers check their code in. Like, if their code is not in your GitHub repo or your GitLab repo or your Bitbucket repo, it doesn't exist, point blank. It doesn't exist, all right? So don't sit there and listen to a senior engineer telling you that it's on their local dev environment and any day now it's going to be working. Tell them to check in the work in the WIP stuff, the work in progress code, and then you go look over it. Because if you're so concerned that you're, you know, squeezing them to operate faster, then you should be concerned enough that you want to actually read the code. And that has always been an effective strategy for me, because yes, I have worked with people who then they don't check it in. And then they don't check it in. And it turns out it never existed in the first place. And yeah, you know, I mean, that's kind of where you gotta, maybe that person needs help in a different way. You know, maybe they're like, I just didn't even know how to get started, man. I was embarrassed to admit it to you. Great. You identified a problem. Let's fix it. You're not going to do that just by veteran velocity and blueberries and pineapples, man. I don't get it. I'm not a big fan of story pointing. I'll sit here and make fun of it all day long.
It is funny to describe it that way, because it really sheds light on how silly it all is to try to figure out how many story points is like something so complex as, I mean, it's a little easier when you break them down. If you've got a really talented product owner or scrum master that knows how to assign the story points, but whenever it's not somebody like you, Brandon, I mean, you could probably accurately do that, but it's not easy to do if you're not a really talented developer. Yeah. And I feel like companies now, they just want to figure out the cheapest way to build their software. They're going to, you know, send things offshore or nearshore, and kind of hurt sometimes to just see it all happen, because it makes you wonder whatever happened to the pride of like things being made in America, being made in the USA. There almost seems to be like no sense of loyalty at all, no obligation for the American companies to actually hire people in the USA. They may hire their chefs on shore, but all the cooks are somewhere else. And then, you know, you were telling me some stories about how, you know, a lot of the work that you've seen over the years has just been fixing these agencyware packages that, you know, your clients have been left with, and it's just a disaster. And it's what it is agencyware. You shipped it offshore and you got what you got, and now they've left you high and dry. And now you have to like hire somebody like you, Brandon, to fix it.
Yeah. I always like to tell people, if you think an expert is expensive, just wait until you see how much an amateur is going to cost you. All right. Just wait and see, because it gets expensive. Boeing paid an engineer, I mean, essentially by time the number got all the way down to the engineer's hourly rate, it was something like $9 an hour, to cost them billions of dollars in reputational damage, government relationship damage, national. The events that have played out at Boeing have been nothing short of heartbreaking. I mean, that was a company that was one of the crown jewels of technology and industry in America. And, you know, you put it into the hands of too many Harvard MBAs, and what you get is a company that seeks to do one thing and one thing only, and that is lower the cost and raise the revenue as much as possible so that we generate profit, right? That is not the goal of Boeing. Boeing's goal should be to build safe airplanes, all right? And they have an amazing way of doing that. They have an amazing production facility up in Washington. I mean, they could spin out like, I mean, the number was something like they can build like 72 planes in a year. I don't know. I mean, I can't even like imagine building more than one jumbo jet in a year. So they're rolling these things through, and it's an engineering-led and managed company, and I mean, they care a lot about this stuff. But flash forward, you know, many years later, and you've got decisions being made to lower costs and the expense of production as much as you possibly can. And yeah, you end up in these really crazy situations where a $9 an hour coder has cost you billions of dollars in lives. And who's to know that, I mean, the people that are writing the code for that system too didn't even really know what the downstream impact was going to be. You know, I mean, that's another thing that I'm not pointing my finger at any one individual saying like, hey, this software engineer caused this thing. I'm saying the decisions of the business led to a situation that is absolutely should be intolerable from anyone, engineers, even business owners, technical people. I mean, people in politics. I mean, I think universally everyone has kind of said what happened at Boeing is a blueprint for what is happening over and over again at a lot of other companies. And we need to stop this from happening. This constant race to the bottom, this constant profit-driven incentive that every single business is being placed under, is doing massive damage to the actual output of, you know, what's coming in. And so I think, you know, when it comes to building software, there may be pieces of software that are absolutely appropriate to offshores. Sure. You know, I'm not going to sit here and ubiquitously across the board say that it's a bad idea. But what I am going to say is, you know, think about where your money's going. Think about where it circulates like back through. You know, if you're going to spend, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on an agency that is offshores, just try to understand, I mean, how that money is being spent, who it's being spent on, you know, how many people are working on this project, and is that an effective operating team? And then, yeah, what happens when that agency decides to go, cool, our engagement is done. Hit us up whenever you're ready for another SOW. And they like did. And then you have to go and you evaluate stakeholders. You do a little piloting and testing, and now you want changes. You go back to that agency and they're like, oh yeah, we're not available. Or, oh yeah, like the people that worked on your thing, they're gone now. They went to go get a job somewhere else. Or, you know, it's like, well, you ended up building a product, not a business. I'm sorry, but I don't think you built a business. You built a product, and that's great. And there's a lot of companies running around trying to build products. I like to work with people that like to build businesses. And yeah, I kind of like to throw that, like, I get a little geeked when I see like the Made in USA thing. And I've made jokes with people. It's like, you know, let's not Made in USA in our software. You know, I mean, like, I just like to take a little pride with the fact that the people that I'm working with are in my local community, you know, and they understand, I mean, the struggles of the customers that we're selling this stuff to. I think that there's a lot of value in that. I think it's a healthy approach for businesses, you know, and I'm not going to try to make any claims that offshore software is of lower quality. But what I will say is, if your business's only goal is to reduce cost as much as possible, I hope you understand fully that you are still going to pay for it. And I hope you understand where that payment is going to come from. You know, it's something that's becoming, you know, I mean, a lot more common. And I think that's also learning how to write software has been a thing that's likely lifted many people up around the world out of poverty into a situation where, I mean, they can finally take care of themselves and their families. So, you know, I don't like to get too hard up, you know, on this statement of like, you should never ever offshores, or all offshores developers are terrible and of bad quality. But what I will say is, you know, if you're looking to build a business, just understand that businesses are comprised of people. And if you're going to take the core thing that your business does and you're going to outsource that to another business, it's that activity right there that I go, well, what is your business doing then? Like, you just sell only, that's it. You take in money from investors and then sell software. I mean, that's not how Microsoft was built. That's not how Google was built. That's not how Apple was built. I mean, I'm sure they have projects that are absolutely offshores, and I'm sure that, I mean, they're working very effectively and they have great control measures, you know, to make that stuff really good. But I would say, for me, working in the startup space, working a lot with businesses that have less than 100 people, there is a lot of power behind the ability to gather everyone together in one common space and from all of them to be on the same team, not like, oh yeah, and our engineering team, they're like remote out there. Hey, wave to us, engineers. And they're like on the phone and they're like, hi. And it's like, yeah, cool. So that's the engineering team. Like, what? Like, let's make an actual team. So I personally have always, I mean, like, found that just working with people in my local community has been a huge thing. I take it even further to kind of say, like, I like remote work. It's great. But I'm always a big advocate for working with companies that, I mean, the employees are like regionally located, at least nearby you. And almost all companies I've worked at, all the staff have been right here in the Triangle of North Carolina. I mean, we have a super, super competent tech community here and amazing universities and really educated people. And I enjoy that kind of work. I really like it. I don't necessarily enjoy having to take 8 p.m. phone calls and have like all of my engagement with an engineer be through like a computer camera, you know, and sometimes not even that. It's like voice only. I would just speak as a software engineer independently, and I would say it's a very difficult environment to work in. It is very difficult to build quality code when, like, I don't know and can't see the people that I'm working with because I'm like speaking through a project manager or something like that. You know, it's not the most enjoyable experience. And again, please, business founders, focus on building a business, not just a product. Businesses are composed of people.
Good advice. Brandon, that's awesome, man. You've been an incredible guest so far. I want to let you have your Friday night, because it is Friday at 5 o'clock. I'm taking my daughter to go roller skating for the first time. We've got rollerblades. Yeah, really? Even I have rollerblades. Yeah, I haven't had rollerblades in over 10 years.
Are you going to like a roller rink? That's kind of coming back a little bit.
I hope so, man. I miss it. I used to do a lot of that when I was in middle school, you know, early high school.
Yeah, my wife and I were just talking about that. Like, whatever happened to the good old roller rink? You know, I mean, that was just like people always talk about it. It's like, you know, what a good thing to like send kids to go do, man. Everyone's always like, man, my kid, they're on VR, they're playing Roblox, Minecraft video game, they got the iPad, this and that. You know, and it's like the only thing you can go to these days is a brewery or a club. I always think, like, man, I forgot roller rinks were a thing, man. I mean, like, that's a solid, like, nice activity for a whole family, man.
I'm looking forward to it.
And, are you a blades guy? Or are you more?
Yeah, I'm a rollerblades. I can't skate. I always, you know, I can't.
Yeah, me too, man.
There's no brake on the back or anything. So if, you know,
your
feet can slide out from under you and it's bad news bears, but I can zip around on rollerblades.
Yeah, I mean, like, I see some people pull some nice tricks on, you know, the skates, but yeah, I'm a blades guy myself. If I ever, you know, do any, like, if I go to a roller rink or anything like that, man, I just feel cooler. I watched a lot of Disney videos growing up, and there's one in particular, I think it was called Point Break, that was like centered all around this like rollerblading crew. And I kind of one summer, that was like that was the only movie I watched, I think. Maybe it left like a permanent ending on me or something, man.
Whenever I go skiing too, if we go to the mountains. Yeah. It's been a while. We're overdue for that. We need to take advantage of that this winter, but also do the snow blades, which are the short skis. Oh man, I have a ball on those. I hate, you know, I can't snowboard.
I can't do
bust, you know, and I hate the long skis and the pole and everything, but those snow blades, man, it's just like rollerblading and you never fall.
Yeah, man. Yeah, that's funny because that's, I mean, my brother, he does the same thing. He likes those blades. I mean, he did the snowboard for a bit, but yeah, man, I'll bust my ass on a snowboard.
But every time.
I haven't been snow skiing in forever, man. I went out on a ski trip with my brothers a while back. They like to go to Vail. I mean, they're in the hardcore slopes. Oh, wow. So I got my skis on. I get to the top of that mountain. I got halfway down and I went, if I break my arm, I can't write code. So I was done. I got too paranoid over just the idea of falling and my wrist getting messed up, man. I was like, what's happened to me? Like, I'm like, you know, my
what family, do you get?
I'm so hungry. If I'm in a cast, what am I going to do? I need that AI to get built quick.
You're going to have to outsource, man. You're going to have to offshore your code.
You know, then maybe I'll have to, I'll get someone remote, you know, I'll just be talking to a black screen, you know, while they're typing or something, you know.
Just tell the AI to make the code, man. Just review it. Say, hey, build this software. When you're done, send me the code review and I'll take a look at it. I'll approve it.
I'm really, really kind of like optimistic. Of like situation like that, man. You know, I think a lot of engineers, the idea of them not typing the code by hand, that's the same mentality that the developers had when they were like, what do you mean I'm not going to manage the memory directly in assembly code? I'm going to write like C now and do this and then. So like, I'm really hoping that I can be like, all right, Jarvis, I want an Iron Man. I want a Tony Stark it. You know, I want to be like, okay, Jarvis, pull up the repository. Let's try to refactor. So that one would like that function. What options could I use to refactor that? Give me three of them. And it's like, bum, bum, bum. You know, that's kind of like experience I really want. Is I want to be able to say stuff to my computer and it presents to me options. And then I select and modify it some. And I'm not having to go, okay, semicolon, open character. Let me get my fingers all jacked up. I want Jarvis, man. I want Tony Stark it. I want to just be standing here and have holograms, I mean, of my code going everywhere too. I mean, that would be too cool, man.
But if you can do that, that's the future, right? You just kind of talk your software into existence, then it's going to be really hard to scale any enterprise level software because everybody can just have their own, right? You have their own customized software. You can make your own customized TV shows. You can prompt your own customized movies that you want to watch every night. You say, I want to watch a movie about Back to the Future, and I want you to break it up into 10 1-hour episodes. I want them to go to this year and this year somehow with these characters and go. And then, boom, here you go. Now you got your show you're going to binge for the next 4 days, nights, right?
Man, yeah.
So. It's going to be crazy.
That's definitely, I mean, you bring up some really good points and, you know, I won't disagree with them at all. You know, I mean, especially on the point of like, if companies can just talk to their computer and build software right away, then, you know, what's the damn point? I would say that expectation is just going to increase. Like now I'll get really crazy with you. How are we going to become like an interstellar species that is going to live on multiple different planets with hyper complex technology that can communicate in real time across like light years of space and all this stuff? We're not going to do it by using the same technology building tools that we have right now. we're going to need more robust and more robust ones. And that's just going to raise the bar for the expectation of software, right? Like the idea of having a game on a little cube that you can play with people all around the world, if you would pitch that in the 80s, they would have been like, huh? That, like, that's like 40 years ago. Now it's 40 years ago. I always think of the 80s as only being like 20 years ago. But
right, yeah.
I think about that stuff. And, you know, that's kind of what – that's always the default I kind of go back to is I go, you know what, Brandon? When this does happen, you won't be building a freaking e-commerce website, you know? Like, I think about that a lot. I spend a lot of time, man, sitting around building e-commerce websites, orders, line items, products, user sign-in, guest checkout, PCI compliance. I can go on and on. I could probably just talk the entire website to you right now because I've done it like five times. Boring, man. Boring. Well, Shopify came along, and I haven't built an e-commerce platform since then. Have I made less money? Absolutely not. Absolutely not, you know? And that's because I'm like, dude, these boring jobs, this boring software that everyone should have, it should just be like totally easy to get to. Yeah. And so our software should just become infinitely more complex, way more complex. You know, I mean,
that's
what I'm hopeful for, you know. So I'll be a bit of an optimist, but at the same time, man, you know, I couple that with the whole, like, the combo we had earlier about the race to the bottom. You know, companies, they want it cheaper, they want it faster. It's everyone's in this, like, race to the bottom when it comes to quality. And I do get to a point a little worried of, like, yeah, nah, man, you know, we got AI that can just make that an e-commerce platform. You know, we don't need that anymore. That worry, I think, drives me to constantly learn new things. You know, I go, I don't want to be that person that got put out of business by Shopify. I want to be that person that just either learned a new thing or became master at Shopify or something like that. You know, I remember working with a guy, you know, way back in the day, man, that was his, like, bread and butter, was building e-commerce websites. He was, like, hyper specialized in it. You know, he considered himself a big time guru, and he was vehemently opposed to Shopify and convinced that they were going to crash. Totally, they're going to crash. That company is dumb. They can't do what I do. There's no way. Well,
Shopify showed him
10% of all e-commerce on the internet now. They figured it out. And now, man, like, anyone can run merch. You know, now you can make a YouTube channel, get your merch line going, open up a storefront. You know, I mean, it's.
I did hear that YouTube is coming for TikTok Shop. Absolutely. All the people pitching little products, and here, the link's right here. Just, you can just buy it right here. In, you never have to leave TikTok. Mm-hmm. And Amazon just struck a deal where you don't even have to leave TikTok to buy things on Amazon. Isn't that crazy? So now YouTube's probably going, like, all right, we got to figure this out. They're obviously not going to ban it yet because they hadn't done it yet. They're probably not going to do it.
I mean, that's what I'm talking about when I'm saying, like, more and more complex with the software, man. You know, I mean, just think what Facebook was like in 2010. It was just a damn shared photo library. That's all that was. You know, you tag friends. People. The most advanced thing that they had was facial recognition, so they could help you tag friends and even suggest tags. That was, like, advanced, you know. Wow. Now it's like, oh, you like this shirt that your friend is wearing in this picture? Click here to buy it. Like, that.
Oof. It's pretty cool, though.
It's a big jump, man.
I just want my Ray-Ban AR glasses. That's what I want.
Exactly. Man, that's what I'm saying. It's like, I do like that shirt, and yes, I do want to buy it. I'll take my buddy's whole swag, man. You know, he can't keep it secret from me anymore. I got AI telling me what he's wearing. I can copy it. But, I mean, it's nuts to think about, man. Like, I mean, YouTube, having, like, an e-commerce store inside of it, and it's, like, this all-encompassing platform. I mean, it really does feel like me, man. Like, people are trending this direction where they're like, you know what, man, Gen Z, they just never leave TikTok. They never leave social media. So let's bring all the stuff we want them to come to. Let's just bring them to them. Buy stuff in TikTok, you know. I mean, I was hanging out with, like, one of my little cousins, and she's like, oh, I don't know how to make spaghetti sauce. And so she searched how to make spaghetti sauce.
In TikTok.
Yeah. I mean, I was like, you're not going to Google this? And she's like, but it's a video that's like, and I was like, she is winning. She got a really good point. She saw no ads, no long blog post about this beautiful spaghetti sauce grandma made with the ingredients and the recipe at the bottom. She just got a nice, straight 60-second video.
Yep.
You know, TikTok, Instagram, Reel, YouTube short of just, like, how to do the thing. I felt like a true boomer in that moment, man. I was like, well, so I started doing that a little bit myself. If I have a coding problem, I'm like, if I'm not getting the results on Google, maybe I will search TikTok, you know? Who knows?
I've done it. Yeah. I YouTube everything.
Yeah.
Well, man, I'm going to wrap. I'm going to let you get back to it. You've been awesome to talk to. We should do this again, but how can people find you, Brandon?
I mean, the best way to get in touch with me is you can just go to brandonmathis.me. That's my personal website. Got a contact field in there. You know, I mean, I do freelance contract web application work, building iOS, Android, mobile web apps for, I mean, both small and enterprise-sized businesses. And I mean, if you ever want to get up with me, chat about anything at all, you just go to brandonmathis.me to check it out. And if you ever want to run into me, like in the physical world, go to triangledevelopers.com. I run a meetup and have been doing it for a while. Right now, we kind of do it in the back room of a bar because we're just like, I mean, it just recently kind of got started, but I've met a lot of, you know, really talented software engineers in the local community by, you know, attending meetups, you know, going to events like All Things Open, which, you know, is supposed to be coming up here in October. I mean, that's a massive technology conference that, you know, happens every single year in Raleigh, North Carolina. I mean, run by a good friend of mine, Todd Lewis, and I never miss a year. I mean, that's all me, man. You know, brandonmathis.me, trianglebevs.com, meet me in person, you know, come hit me up. We can do some work together. Go to All Things Open. We can hang out some more. You know, I mean, I'm technology and software is my life, man. It's all encompassing for me now. So
I love it. Love it. Well, yeah, you've crushed it here today, man. And I've enjoyed it.
For sure. Well, have fun, man. All right. Enjoy all yourself. Right.
Hey, and, thanks, man.
Happy on the podcast and going, you know, I mean, we went 2 whole hours, man. So
pure gold, all this content, good stuff, man. We're going to get some good clips from it.
Okay. But,
all right, brother. Have a good one.
Blake, take it easy, man. Peace.
Hey, man.